You're listening to World Oil's Deep Dive, where you'll get to know the authors of technical articles in World Oil magazine and learn more about their company's technology and how it's shaping our industry. Now, here's your host, Jim Watkins.
We're here today with Carrie Mertland from Evolution Well Services. Carrie's the Vice President of Technology and Marketing. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you.
This is your first time on a podcast, right?
It is, Jim. This is my first time.
But this is a really interesting article that you wrote for us. It's in the May 2019 issue of World Oil. It starts on page 51. And so you did write it, right?
I did write it.
Okay.
I apologize to all the readers because I am an engineer, so.
All right. Well, before we start getting into the article, though, tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure.
How did you get into engineering and then end up in the frack business?
Sure. So engineering was a pretty easy choice from small town Michigan. And my sister and I basically spent our time stealing tools from our dad out of the garage and running wild on about 80 acres behind the house building things. So we were sort of the sons that our dad didn't have. So we were engineering from an early age. I ended up going to engineering school at Michigan Tech. And for those of you who don't know, Michigan Tech is located at the end of the earth, basically. It's in the northern part of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And it's like, once the freeway stops, you drive for another 4.5 hours. No joke. So it's a great place for an engineering school because everybody's got to be really resourceful. You can't get to a large city anywhere nearby and get things. So engineering was a huge focus at Michigan Tech. So they were really known for two things there, one of which was engineering, and the other was forestry. So it sounds like a strange kind of pairing for two things to specialize in for a school, but it actually worked out really well because what it did is it showed people that, okay, so we've got this natural resource, the forests, and you have to find a balance between, you know, conserving the environment and never cutting a tree down, but then the realization that, well, we need pulp and paper, we need heating wood, we need these things. So how can we utilize this resource in a responsible manner? So it was really something that segued well into oil and gas, and especially into what we're doing here and using natural gas as a clean burning fuel, because it's a good balance of using natural resources, but using them in a very sustainable way.
Right.
That sort of preserves the environment.
Yep.
So the engineers and the forestry majors ended up working really closely together on all these projects. So there was sort of this flavor of environmentalism, but also this very entrepreneurial, you know, business savvy feel to it as well. So
wow.
It was a great place to learn.
And so what kind of engineering were you studying?
Chemical engineering.
Chemical engineering.
Yes.
And so then what kind of led you to this part of the business? Was it because of the fracking or?
No, actually not at all. So I had a degree concentration in alternative fuels in college.
Oh, okay.
Graduated in 2009, just in time for this like massive economic downturn. So here I am, this person with, you know, student loans to pay back, and got a job in oil and gas in Houston. So started off for a couple of years designing topsides production facilities for offshore platforms.
So no chemical engineering at all, just regular engineering.
It was process engineering.
Yeah,
so,
okay.
So some chemical engineering, but not a whole lot. Did that for a couple of years, got recruited over to the Weir Group in their oil and gas division, SPM.
Mm-hmm.
And so I moved up there for about 6 years before getting a call from Evolution asking if I wanted to come and work here. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. Prior to joining Evolution, I had kind of seen what they were doing, this mad science project they were building out in the metropolis of Splendora, Texas. So for a couple of years, they were building this fleet, and I'd go out and visit basically as a vendor to them. And even though I wasn't really selling anything, I'd stop by because what they were doing was just so cool. So I remember the first visit out there. I go in, and in the office at that time on location was a single wide trailer. You know, these guys are out there literally with this mad science project. And we sat down without many pleasantries and quickly got into this 2-hour, very technical conversation about how pumps work and how we can do this. And I just noticed the amount of detail that they were putting into this technology.
Mm-hmm.
It was just mind boggling. So from then on, yeah, I was a believer. I said, man, these guys are it. They're not focused on trying to be a Me Too. They're not trying to be a fast follower. These guys are leaders.
So, right.
A couple of years later, I got a call from the president, and he said, I think you ought to join us over at Evolution. I said, wow, well, this is be like a dream. What do you want me to do?
Right, exactly.
He said, I don't know. Just come and we'll figure it out.
So, nice.
Yeah.
That is quite a career path.
Yeah.
That's definitely one of the things that people have to pay attention to. And I think I mentioned to you that one of our other podcasts, right, the Engineering Your Oil and Gas Career podcast, that one emphasizes that in every episode. Be flexible.
Yes.
You know, because you don't know how your career path's going to go. You just have to be open to opportunities and take advantage, you know, so.
That's it.
Now, and look at this, and now you have a published article in the magazine, so there you go. And so, once again, that article's on page 51 in the May 2019 issue. It's called Fueling Fracturing with Natural Gas, Redefining Wellsite Power for Oilfield Services. And this is Carrie's article, and here's the basic crux and focus of the article is, it's in the very first paragraph. The challenges of fueling hydraulic fracturing operations come in many forms, including consistent fuel supply, efficiency, emissions, and safety. And so in this article, Carrie, you go through and you address each one of those issues and, you know, how you at Evolution and EFRAC in general are addressing those, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So let's start on. So you start out with a very interesting story about Harvey, Hurricane Harvey, and having to shut down a frac spread. Well, actually, it wasn't even shut down, was it? It was brand new out there.
It actually was shut down. So it had been deployed just recently before the storm had rolled in.
So it was already working, and then they had to shut it down for the storm.
Yes.
And then everything, they buttoned everything up, came back out, everything was working, and they just fired it back up and went back to work. But, you know, when you read that first thing, you're like, wow, that's a pretty good story, but who cares?
Yeah, right.
and then in the very next one, you start talking about, I love this paragraph, it says, what was not realized at the time was that the majority of other frac fleets in the basin were still not operational, and they wouldn't be for many days or weeks yet to come. Now, this is the very first thing we're talking about, right? Fuel supply. So,
yes.
So give us a little rundown on that. How does electric fracking work? Because that was always my question. I'm not a technical guy. It's like, wait a second, that's great that you can, you know, run electric motors and stuff and to run pumps, but where do you get the electricity?
Sure. So typically with a conventional fracturing fleet, you are powered by a large number of diesel engines. So when you need fuel for those diesel engines, you rely on tanker trucks to be dispatched to location and deliver fuel basically continuously to your diesel engines to power your frac. What we realized through kind of a roundabout way is that in some cases there is abundant natural gas available. So natural gas has gained a lot of popularity as a fuel in recent years. And we saw this and we said, hey, what if we took a turbine, burned natural gas that's already right there at the well site in many instances, and generate our own power? So that's exactly what we did. And so in short, rather than burning diesel, you burn natural gas as a fuel source, and that powers your frac.
Interesting. And that's what you go on to talk about from that story, was that because you had the fuel source there, everybody else was waiting on trucks and things to get back on the road. The refineries had been taken offline because of the storm. So there was that issue of supply. And with EFRAC, you had none of that.
That's correct.
Right. Yeah.
Yep.
So, and then you go on to talk about using the turbine and the development of the turbine. And I also thought that was really interesting because you talk about using this General Electric turbine, right, in the beginning.
Yes.
And then what happened after that? Because in the article, it goes on to explain how it became, I guess, necessary to customize that.
Yes. Yes, it did. So we selected an off-the-shelf package from General Electric to power our frac fleets. It was the TM2500+. This was a great package. We were really successful with it for the first 2 years of our commercial life. What we started to notice, though, is it was taking us anywhere from 4 to 7 days to mobilize this turbine from one well site to the next. So in a business where time is so critical to, well, making money, it was important to find a package that could be moved in much less time. So I asked an operator the other day, I said, okay, so when we're talking about reducing the time it takes to move from one well site to the next, what does that mean to you in terms of dollars? He says, well, $6,000 an hour.
Wow.
So when you do the math there, you take 2 days off of each move and you do two moves a month. So you're taking 96 hours at $6,000 an hour and you're saving them an additional $7 million a year just by moving 2 days faster.
Wow.
So we started to see that math and realized that we needed a package that was going to be not only highly mobile, but rugged, made for rough oil field lease roads. So then we began engineering of our own package, which is the Dynamis solution that you see there.
Right. And tell me about Dynamis, because when you're reading this, I thought that was very interesting too. That it was like, well, wait a second, we need this special design. So let's make a spinoff, right?
I mean, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the creation of Dynamis was really driven by this demand that we were seeing for this mobile power package that we had come up with. So we started to get a lot of calls that were not just for fracturing, but we started to get calls from operators saying, hey, this is giving us an idea. We want to make our own infield power grid. Or like recently, we got a request from a company in Canada. And they said, we need like a bunch of these packages. We need a ton of power. And we said, well, what do you want to use this for? And they said, marijuana grow operations.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah, right? This is something we never thought we'd hear. That and mining of cryptocurrencies.
Oh, of course. Yeah, that's energy intensive for sure.
Extremely energy intensive.
Right.
So when we started getting these calls that were from various industries other than oil and gas, we figured that it would be a good time to sort of spin off, have a sister company. It just made more sense that way.
Yeah. No, that is interesting. And yeah, for remote operations or places where you want to set something up, I mean, that's a great way to go. But I think that could be like a whole article about, you know, electric grids in the field and stuff like that. That could be a fantastic piece.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So when you're talking about making it mobile or making it more mobile and rugged, for me, I was just trying to picture in my mind what that meant. Was that just like putting it on a different trailer, or was it not on a trailer and you had to mount it on the ground? I mean, how did you make it better?
Well, not only was it on a trailer, it was on five trailers.
Five trailers?
Yes. Yeah, so one of the reasons that it took, you know, 4 to 7 days to mobilize this thing was it required heavy crane lifts to lift the exhaust stack on top of the engine and so on and so forth. So we downsized it from five trailers to two trailers.
Oh, wow.
Yes. We've eliminated the need for any crane picks. So from a safety perspective, that's huge. You're no longer lifting something the size of a semi-trailer into the air, and also increase mobility greatly.
Wow. That is impressive. And so now on page 52, you have a nice little diagram there of how the turbine generator fits into the overall system, right? Mm-hmm. But in the second column, about a third of the way down, a quarter of the way down, talk about rounding out the frac fleet and the other aspects of the frac fleet that were made better by not having traditional diesel motors, right? Basically,
yes.
was the reason. And one of those you're talking about was just the overall footprint, right?
Yes. Yeah. So the footprint of our fleet is less than half the size, not only of just diesel, but of any other frac fleet out there. So the way that we accomplished that was we realized that we needed a high horsepower density. So conventional units typically have anywhere from 2,000 to 2,500 horsepower on each individual pump unit. We've got 7,000.
Mm.
And that 7,000, not to get too technical, but the 7,000 horsepower is hydraulic horsepower, available horsepower to put down hole. When you talk about a conventional diesel engine coupled to a transmission, coupled to a pump, the horsepower that's labeled on that unit is brake horsepower of the engine.
Right. And so you're losing it all down the system.
You're losing upwards of 15% by the time you get to the pump portion. So we have taken two pumps, put them on one trailer, and driven both of those pumps with a single electric motor.
Wow.
Yes.
That's impressive. And so, yeah, that definitely contributes to, as a matter of fact, Isn't there an image on one of these other pages? Do we have an image of that? We'll have to get one for the show notes, because I know you have good images of how small that footprint is, you know, because when people are used to seeing aerial images of frac fleets and, you know, how all-encompassing that is and all the trucks and everything, and you see an electric frac fleet there, you're just like, wow, that is small.
Yeah. Yeah. In some basins, it's extremely important. So particularly in Appalachia, these pad sizes that are kind of like perched on the tops of these mountains, they make them just big enough to fit a drilling rig in a lot of cases, but not necessarily large enough to fit an entire frac fleet.
Right.
So what they're having to do is operators in the area are having to spend upwards of $1 million to go back to an existing pad that has had wells drilled and expand the pad to be large enough to fit a conventional fleet.
Wow.
Now, if you figure that this is happening once a month, you're talking about pad expansions of sometimes $10 or $12 million a year just to get a frac fleet to fit on it.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, that is good. And then you go on to list the other things, like, for example, and this is something that, you know, not being technical, I would have never thought of the hydraulic harmonic vibration.
Yes.
So explain to us, what is that? What is harmonic vibration?
So on a frac, regardless of service company, if you go out there and ask what makes pieces of equipment fail, this high pressure iron, pumps, what's making things fail out there? A lot of times there are these massive vibrations that are induced through just the sheer amount of horsepower on location. If you start to get pumps, you know, if you say you've got 20 fracturing pumps out there, and they're all working at just slightly different frequencies, and together they'll create this wild wave of vibration. And I mean, when you pull up onto location of a conventional fleet, you step out and you feel the earth move. Mm. I mean, you can feel this. So we noticed that we could get around this vibration in a lot of ways. One of which is we have this complex system in how we control our pumps so that they work together in the control system. So when we start to see a vibration, they'll balance each other out and kind of automatically correct itself. And
right.
In addition to that, all of our units are lay down trailers. They all lay flat on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
We don't own a single tractor.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So we drop the equipment on location and it sits there until the job is over.
Ah, okay. Interesting. And you go on to talk about the other parts of the frac fleet as well, like the blender. So you guys make your own blender as well?
We do.
Okay.
Yes. We make a blender, but we should really call it two blenders because it's two completely independent blenders that are coupled onto one trailer. So again, with this idea of a smaller footprint, we've taken a blender, also have yourself a backup blender, all in one trailer on location.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay. That is, wow. That is, that really does help save space. And that's amazing that you guys designed your own as opposed to, you know, picking up another blender from somebody else or just trying to cobble it in so you can have it exactly the way you want it.
It is. Yes. And on the blender, as well as the other pieces of equipment, we've got hundreds of electric motors on our fleet. And mm-hmm. those range in size from fractional horsepower up to 7,000 horsepower. The one common thing, though, is that they're all controlled by variable frequency drives. So what, right? Well, this is really important for a couple of reasons. One, it allows you to have infinite adjustability over
right.
anything out there. So on a traditional unit, you've got to choose between a gear on your transmission. So
right.
you know, you'll hear him say, grab a gear.
Mm-hmm.
With this, you've got infinite adjustability of how fast or how much you want to pump. And what else it does is that we noticed kind of as an accidental value proposition is we started to notice when we were pumping that when your valves would get close to failure, the VFD would feed this strange frequency back to the data van.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that is it's allowing us to kind of lay the groundwork for predictive maintenance. So,
yeah.
Whereas a conventional unit wouldn't have that. So,
hi, this is Andy McDowell, publisher of World Oil. Thank you for joining the podcast today. Please make sure to check out worldoil.com for more news, technical articles, and case histories on upstream technology. Now back to the show.
Right, exactly. And that's the whole data van, data collection, because along with all of this, you have sensors on everything that's picking up all of this and crunching all the numbers, right?
Absolutely.
Wow. That it's a I'll tell you, it's impressive. It's an impressive thing to see. Hopefully, everybody will get a chance to actually see it, maybe at a show, because I know you bring the trailers around or even out in the field, yes, more importantly. And so then you go on to talk about, I thought this was really interesting too, because of course, with electrical fracking, this would be an issue. But you talk about reducing the number of ground cables,
yes,
right? From 56 down to 16.
Mm-hmm.
You made like umbilicals or something, like one cable that has a lot of cables in it, or?
Sort of. So what we did is we took basically the entire electrical design, the entire one line of the system. We sat down and we looked at it and thought, how can we design this to be extremely mobile, extremely safe? How can we reduce the number of hazards on location? And what we came up with is we need fewer cables. Because when we're talking about cables here, you're not talking about a cable that plugs into the wall kind of size.
Right, exactly.
So the size of these cables, they're as big around as your forearm.
Wow.
Yes. So we're carrying 13,800 volts through these cables. So what we did is we took fiber optic communication lines. We had this cable designed that has communication lines that run with the power cable that enable us to get to that reduction in cables. So it's a big deal, because not only is that type of cable extremely expensive, we're talking, you know, $10, $20 a foot, but it's also reducing the hazard on site. Trip hazards on location account for a massive amount of injuries. So,
really?
Yeah.
Just tripping over
just
cables
tripping over
and pipes
stuff,
and things?
Yeah,
exactly.
High pressure iron. Yeah. So we actually have a lot that goes into cable management. So we regularly ultrasonically test all of our cables between locations to make sure the jackets are right. So when you get that number to 16 instead of 59 or 60, you reduce the time required to do that maintenance significantly.
Oh, absolutely. And then you go on to talk about, I love this, is the greener alternative, right? So talking about green fracking and how much less environmental pollution there is, right? So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this was wild. I read just this week that in Q1, in the Permian alone, there were 661 million cubic feet of natural gas flared.
Wow.
And that's
just burned off,
measured.
Just gone. Yeah.
Just measured. So to give you kind of a frame of reference, that would be enough to power 165 of Evolution's fleets, which would essentially be enough to provide all of the completions horsepower needed for the Permian.
Wow.
Yeah.
And and that's energy just being burned off.
Just burned off.
Nobody cares.
Just burned off.
Got no way of capturing it, and we could be using it.
We could be using it. So it's interesting, too, with the whole LNG craze that's going on. And this is fuel that could legitimately be exported. So right now, we're seeing a lot of this. So in the past, like Russia and Europe, for example, Europe has been completely dependent on Russia to feed them all of their energy. Now, for the first time, we're being able to export LNG to Europe, create some competition, get them out of this monopoly. And yeah, so this is absolutely fuel that could be used. So,
yeah, no, that is one of the aspects, you know, when you start talking about electric fracking, that hadn't even come to my mind.
Yeah.
You know, that, wait a second, we're using this basically waste fuel, mm-hmm, to fuel these. And then when you go on to page 54, the next page, when you turn that, one of the things that I made a little note about was you see a picture like right in the middle of the page, and what it is are like sandbanks or frac sand towers there. And you see one set that's like pristine white and another one that's kind of gray and just nasty looking. And I actually, when I first saw that photo, I thought that somebody had touched up the ones on the left and forgot to touch up the ones on the right. But tell us about that photo.
Yeah, so this is interesting. The photo that you're speaking of, we had this, what's called a six-pack of sand silos. And the six-pack of silos had been supplying us sand for fracs pad to pad to pad. It had been with us for quite some time. We started to see our efficiencies really grow. We were pumping a whole lot more sand. We actually ended up setting a record there and in another basin for most sand pumped in a day. But so we called and we said, hey, we need another six-pack of silos out here. So they deliver this second six-pack to us. And the second six-pack had been following another frac fleet around as well, but it was a conventional fleet.
Mm.
So in the picture, what you see, the pristine white six-pack had been with us for a long time. not seeing the diesel soot basically accumulate on it. And the one on the right just shows literally black and white what the difference in emissions truly is.
Yeah. No, that's a powerful photo right there. I mean, if I was working on a site, I'd definitely want to be working on an electric one, right? You don't want to be smelling and inhaling all of that nasty soot, that's for sure. And then further on page 54, you talk about applying lean principles to completions, right? And how this Sigma 6 principles like movement, weighting, transportation, and extra processing, how using electric frac fleets kind of, I don't know, ticks all those boxes, right?
Yes. Which
makes that makes it a natural choice when you're talking about efficiency. So go through each one of those, because I mean, you're talking about movement and the diesel and all of that stuff, and the people who are bringing it. And also this paragraph afterward about the hot fueling, again, not technical. So I never even thought about that, but that seems like a disaster waiting to happen right there, hot fueling. So yeah, talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So Six Sigma principles, there's these sort of like pillars. I think we're up to eight of them now, which are sort of areas of waste, things you want to eliminate in a business to really grow your efficiencies. One of them is movement. So what you avoid in the movement category with electric frac is movement of tanker trucks. You're not moving tanker trucks to transport hydrocarbons to a refinery or from a refinery. You're not trucking diesel fuel from the rack. You know, you're not doing any of these things anymore. So you're not moving as many things, which is one of the forms of waste. Weighting is another one that's closely associated with this. So anytime that you ever go out to a frac fleet, the first thing you will notice as you're driving to location is whether they're sand trucks, whether they're water trucks, whether they're diesel trucks, there will be a line of trucks sitting waiting to get on location or to get off of location. Transportation fits closely with that. So think about if you're in the Permian and you have a hydrocarbon that you get out of the ground. You send that hydrocarbon via pipeline or some other way over to the coast, to the refinery. So it's making this huge journey. You're putting all of this energy in it to refine it. And then out of that process, you're getting diesel.
Right.
You're taking the diesel, then you're sending it all the way back to the Permian.
Right, exactly. In a truck or...
In a truck. And it's just, you know, if you look at that and you look at the constraints in the Permian right now, there's this massive issue of so many trucks on the road. Mm-hmm. It's dangerous. It makes traffic a nightmare. So if we just grabbed our fuel from the edge of location, you could cut all that out.
Exactly. And using the gas on location is a lot easier than building a small refinery right there.
Absolutely.
So talk a little bit about the hot fueling too, because like I said, that for me, that's just mind blowing.
Yes.
That they would even do that.
Yes. So thankfully, we're getting to a point now where there are some automation features within these hot fueling systems, which take people out of harm's way at least. But equipment is still often in harm's way. So what we're talking about when we say hot fueling is, as you're pumping a job, you've got all these diesel engines out there. Well, they need continuous fuel. I mean, we're talking about 5.5 million gallons of diesel fuel consumed by a frac fleet in a year.
Mm-hmm.
So you've constantly got this string of tankers coming in to refuel these units. Well, you're putting fuel into an engine as it's running.
Right, exactly.
And you've got this massive amount of horsepower, all these flame ignition sources. So it's pretty easy, actually, to see how a fire could be ignited out there.
Yeah.
So last year alone, there were about $118 million in insurance claims for fracturing fires. And most of the causes, they believe, are hot fueling.
Yeah, it would seem like that's a very weak point in the system. I mean, you know, yeah, when you think about it, and that's something I knew they operated continuously when they were running fracs and stuff, and that there was no breaks, but it never dawned on me, wait a second, continuously means they have to get fuel continuously, right?
Yeah.
So how are you going to make that happen? And I guess there's a reason why at a gas station, they want you to shut off your motor, right?
Exactly. That's a great point. Yes, yeah, exactly.
It's true.
Yeah.
And it's quieter too. And I think this is really important when it comes down to like what you see with the legislation going on in Colorado, and the closer that populations come to, you know, extraction operations, noise is a bigger and bigger thing, right?
It is huge. It is huge. You're seeing people invest a ton of money in ways to try to get their fleets to be quieter. And even after these massive investments, we're still at least 10 decibels quieter than them. So this is important in so many places and for so many reasons. And just a couple of the calls we've gotten recently. One was an operator that's actually still working in the Barnett. And they called and they said, well, we want to talk to you guys. We just heard how quiet you were and we're daylight only.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So if they were to utilize us, they would actually be able to pump around the clock. So you're talking about doubling the amount of time you could pump in a day.
Right.
In Oklahoma City, we had another call. So there's an operator who was pumping like right in the city. And he calls and he says, hey, this, you know, we'll call him Jimmy.
Right.
Jimmy showed up in the data van today again. So Jimmy is an angry resident that lives, you know, a couple blocks away. And he's sick of the noise that this frack fleet's making.
Mm-hmm.
So even in a place like Oklahoma, which is pretty oil and gas friendly.
Yeah.
You're seeing a massive amount of pressure from the congressman to quiet these things down.
Yeah. And so that plays into that. But when you were talking about the decibels there, I was trying to pick that out. So like 110 is the OSHA safety level. Is that like if you're above 110, that's too loud?
So 110 is about what a conventional frack fleet will operate at.
Okay, that's really loud.
It's pretty loud. Yeah, it's very loud. So we're about 85 decibels, and 85 decibels is the level which OSHA says, you know, below 85, it doesn't even require hearing protection.
Right. I don't know if I ever, I probably didn't tell you this story, but when I first moved to Houston 3 years ago, one of the things that blew me away was when I went to restaurants with clients, how loud they were on the inside. I mean, coming from Europe where people talk in hushed whispers in restaurants and it's always very quiet, to a place where it was so loud. So I actually bought a decibel meter and I would take it around with the restaurants to me to just because it was so loud. And I'm telling you, there were restaurants that were higher than 85 decibels.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It was mind blowing, you know, to me.
We had a group yesterday out from the Railroad Commission of Texas. We had 20 some folks that we were touring on a location yesterday, and many of them had never been on a frack location. And the ones that have, we get there, and when we get there, we were already pumping a stage. So we're standing outside, and one of the more experienced guys goes, when do you start? I'm like, that's it.
It's happening right now.
That's happening right now. Yeah.
Yep. And so then you conclude the article on page 55, talking about what evolves, evolution again in the name, what evolves from this technology going forward. And you talked about some interesting projects like with Solaris.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So this is exciting to us because these kind of projects that are actually getting requested of us by the clients, these are showing us that the technology is not only accepted, but we've got clients out there who are thinking, how else can I use this? How can we expand this technology? So the first place that we saw that was powering the Solaris silos on location. So we talked to our friends at Solaris. Hey, what do you guys think? Yeah, absolutely. They were set up perfectly for it anyway. And so we just feed them power. And the honestly, the biggest challenge there is who's going to carry the cable? So it's just so easy to do. We're starting to get some bigger challenges now. We're working on some projects to electrify wireline. So,
oh yeah, right.
Yeah. So our clients have these visions of a completely electric location, no diesel engines whatsoever. So we're getting there, and we're getting there very quickly.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating, like you said, because when you're talking about research and areas where it might be able to be used, where these turbines might be able to be used, you know, nobody knows better than the people who are out there. And they're like, wait a second, we could do this with electricity. If only we had electricity. And there they go. Then they're right in your pocket.
Absolutely.
So now, and so you talk also about heat capture, capturing the heat off of the turbines to be used for heating water in cold areas and heating many things, I would imagine, in cold operations, right?
Yes, that's correct. We were a bit baffled and surprised. We started to hear how much operators are having to pay in cold weather climates to heat either frack water to use in the process or heating, heat tracing of wellheads and things to keep things from freezing up. People are paying hundreds of thousands a month to heat water. So we're like, wait a second. We've got this turbine. It's throwing off exhaust at 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit. There's got to be something we can do here.
Right.
So we got together. We started to sketch up some cartoons, worked with some engineering firms, and have developed this heat exchanger. And for cold weather operation, it can be placed right next to the turbine package. And we would be able to heat water either for downhole use or for heat tracing or anything else on location, 30 degrees Fahrenheit at a rate of 110 barrels a minute.
Wow.
Yes.
That's impressive.
And it otherwise wasted heat. So if you take that, save your operator another $200K a month in heating costs, it's just a smarter way to do it.
Yeah. No, it's very interesting because, you know, all of these ideas lead to other ideas, and it seems kind of like a rabbit hole of ideas and ways that you can do things differently that we haven't done in the past. Mm-hmm. And that's the most exciting thing about this article about the electric fracking business, I think, is that it is the beginning stages.
It is.
So hopefully, you know, you'll be able to come back and tell us more about some of these other ancillary projects as well, you know, in the future. And we'll be able to get another article out of you for the magazine.
Absolutely. We would be honored. And thank you, Jim, so much. It's been such a pleasure. And again, we love the opportunity to kind of talk about our technologies.
Yeah, it is impressive, Carrie. So thank you very much. And once again, for those of you who were listening, that's Carrie's article, Fueling Fracturing with Natural Gas, Redefining Wellsite Power for Oilfield Services, on page 51 in the May 2019 issue of World Oil. Thanks again, Carrie.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks for listening. Take a look at today's show notes for links we mentioned in the podcast. We enjoy your feedback, so if you have any questions or comments, email them to deepdive@worldoil.com. Check out worldoil.com for the best oil and gas industry technical articles and news. And join us next time for another Deep Dive with World Oil.